America's warning dilemmas have now multiplied. Its enemy can strike from anywhere, even from within the United States. The enemy is also adept at turning America's infrastructure against itself, so it need not marshal forces or build stockpiles. And henceforth, surprise attack must be regarded as the natural order of things. This imposes two burdens. American planners must unshackle their thinking and disregard no possibility because it seems unlikely. In the wake of September 11th, for example, senior U.S. officials explained that they did not think that Al-Qaeda had the ability to attack the United States and that the threat of aerial attack had been considered, but only with respect to small commuter aircraft. The introduction to Roberta Wallstedt's study of the Pearl Harbor disaster observes that there is a tendency in our planning to confuse the unfamiliar with the improbable. The contingency we have not considered seriously looks strange. What looks strange is therefore improbable. What is improbable need not be considered seriously. The writer could well have been describing the analytical failure that preceded September 11th. The second burden is to probe the enemy to put him off balance. This is easier said than done, of course, but the United States has carried out clandestine operations against rival intelligence services for precisely this purpose in the past. Al-Qaeda, or whatever replaces it, will be a harder target, but perhaps not an impossible one. Nor do probes have to be covert operations. For example, the United States has the capability to raid Al-Qaeda-affiliated camps in Yemen. Without occupying territory, raiders could seize documents, destroy weapons, vehicles, and materiel, plant hard-to-find audio and movement sensors for continuous intelligence collection, and perhaps carry out other tasks as well. These two burdens, institutionalizing imaginativeness and probing the enemy, are the only ways to limit the frequency and scale of the surprises that await us. There is yet more to the new strategic order. By definition, surprise attacks cannot be preempted. There are no enemy aircraft neatly lined up on the ramp for the United States to destroy, as they were in Egypt when Israel launched its successful preemptive attack in June 1967. Nor are there targets like the Iraqi nuclear reactor that was preventively bombed by the Israeli Air Force in 1981, just before it went hot. A virtual enemy operating in secret is unlikely to offer such opportunities. Deterrence is not an option either. An enemy that has no territory to protect and whose forces crave martyrdom will not be deterred by threat of retaliation. At best, he may be stymied temporarily if he thinks he cannot achieve his goal because of the defenses he faces. With preemption unavailable and deterrence simply irrelevant, the United States is in deep and unfamiliar waters. A way out of this conceptual cul-de-sac may emerge, but in the meantime, the United States and its allies will be thrown back onto a strategy centered on defense. This conundrum had already been recognized in 1998 in the Presidential Decision Directive on Homeland Defense. The preamble to that directive, which summed up the justification for it, stated that the United States was entering an era during which the provenance and nature of threats to national security could no longer be confidently predicted. Attacks could come from any direction and with extraordinary force. Borders were no longer barriers. The directive concluded that in the face of this diffuse, nameless, and all-azimuth danger, the government must focus less on specific threats than on identifying and remedying the country's vulnerabilities. Two other radical departures from the past must be understood as America gropes toward a reorientation to the challenge of the new terrorists. The first is that the historic distinction in American strategy between foreign and domestic has been erased. This has implications for law enforcement and intelligence gathering, of course, but also for civil liberties. The second is that the boundary between the private and public sectors has, in effect, been eliminated. The jihadists are not engaging the American military in overseas battles of maneuver and attrition. Victory for them is killing American civilians, preferably on American soil. If they intend to continue using America's own infrastructure, a cornucopia of opportunities for mayhem, then the defense of that infrastructure will inevitably fall to those who own it. By and large, the U.S. government owns and controls very few of these national assets: transportation systems, computer networks, telecommunications systems, energy production and distribution, food production, water storage. An effective defense will require thoroughgoing cooperation between Washington and the corporations or public utilities and local authorities to whom this infrastructure belongs.